welcome to this reading of the Sioux City Journal for today, Friday, June 17th. I'm your reader, Mark Bedford. Let's start with today's weather. Today will be hot with plenty of sunshine and a high of 91 degrees. Tonight will be partly cloudy with a low of 70 degrees. And then tomorrow, Saturday, will be mostly sunny, becoming windier and hot with a high of 96 degrees. And now these local news stories. Reynolds signs jobless benefit cutback. Benefits cut from 26 weeks to 16, among shortest in the U.S. Aaron Murphy reports from Des Moines. Unemployed workers in Iowa will be eligible to receive state unemployment benefits for 10 fewer weeks under legislation signed into law Thursday by Governor Kim Reynolds. The new law reduces the length of state unemployment benefits from 26 weeks to 16. Iowa becomes just the fourth state with 16 weeks or fewer of state unemployment benefits. It was one of three workforce-related bills that Reynolds signed into law Thursday. Reynolds, in a news release, said the new laws modernize Iowa's unemployment system and will attract new workers to Iowa businesses. It's no secret that Iowa, like the rest of the country, is facing a critical workforce shortage. But we cannot stand idle and allow employable Iowans to sit on the sidelines, and we must implement practical and efficient changes that cut through bureaucratic red tape and assist employers with filling their critical vacancies, Reynolds said in the news release. I am confident these changes will encourage more Iowans to join the workforce and find a rewarding career while contributing to our economy. The new law also changes the requirements for taking a job that pays less than the unemployed Iowan's previous job. Previously, a person receiving unemployment benefits had 6 weeks before having to accept a lower-paying job. The new law shortens that time frame. After 1 week, a person on unemployment will have to accept a job offering 90% of that person's previous wages. That threshold would drop to 80% after 3 weeks, 75% after 5 weeks, and 60% after 8 weeks. The legislation, House File 2355, passed Iowa legislature with only Republican support. The progressive advocacy group Progress Iowa issued a statement Thursday critical of the reduction in unemployment benefits, saying it will hurt laid-off workers, suppress wages, and make Iowa an unwelcoming state. As Iowans, we value hard work and know good-paying jobs help Iowa grow. But now, Iowa Republicans are doing all they can to force workers to take jobs that don't pay enough. Progress Iowa Executive Director Matt Sinovic said in a news release, "We know that taking away our hard-earned benefits won't solve the Reynolds workforce crisis. We need our lawmakers to invest in working families and make corporations pay what they owe." Reynolds on Thursday also signed into law legislation that allows 16 and 17-year-olds to work unsupervised at child care centers. The new law also allows child care centers to operate with one worker for every 7 2-year-olds and one worker for every 10 3-year-olds. Supporters of the new law have said it will help with shortages of staffing and available slots at childcare centers. Critics have said it does not go far enough to properly address those issues, and note that it does not contain any provision that would help address childcare workers' low wages or funding designed to entice the creation of more childcare centers. House File 2198 passed the Iowa legislature largely along party lines, with Republicans supporting and Democrats opposing. South Dakota state senators silent on Ravensburg impeachment vote. Stephen Groves reports from Sioux Falls. State senators are staying silent on how they will vote in South Dakota's first-ever impeachment trial next week, as they weigh whether to remove Attorney General Jason Ravensburg for his conduct surrounding a 2020 fatal car crash. The Associated Press asked each of the 35 members of the Republican-controlled Senate whether they had made a decision on the two impeachment charges that will be argued starting Tuesday. None of the 20 who responded said they had reached a decision. Most liken themselves to jurors or judges who must give a fair hearing in an ordeal that has fractured the state's Republican Party and galvanized public opinion. "Everybody's keeping an objective mind and going into it with their eyes wide open," said Republican Senator Aaron Tobin. It will take 24 senators, or two-thirds, to convict Ravensburg, a first-time Republican who isn't seeking re-election, on either of two articles of impeachment, committing crimes that caused the death of pedestrian Joseph Bover and malfeasance afterward. The circumstances surrounding the two-day trial may have already tipped some senators as they review crash investigation files and material from the House impeachment investigation. Ravensburg's defense hasn't submitted any documents, so everything they have looked at likely works in the prosecution's favor. It would be hard for anyone to look at that information and not come to a conclusion, said Republican Senator Michael Roll. We haven't seen a defense. Roll said he hasn't made up his mind. Most of his questions are for Ravensburg, who has not said whether he will testify. Other senators have had less time to do their homework on the crash investigation. Republican Senator Ryan Mayer said he is already agitated because he will have to take a two-day break from running a new business to spend long hours in a Senate chamber, likely baking in the summer heat. Lawmakers usually meet during the winter months, making air conditioning or cooling ventilation unnecessary. It's going to be hot, and we're just going to sit there and sweat, Mayer said. He said he did not know how he would vote, but said if Ravensburg is convicted, he would probably vote to bar him from holding any future state office, just because he's wasting my time now when he should have resigned. Other senators said they were looking forward to a trial as a public reckoning over crash details that have emerged in fits and starts in the 21 months since Ravensburg struck Bover as he drove home from a Republican gathering. Ravensburg has said he did not know he killed a man until he returned to the crash site the next day and discovered Bover's body. He initially told a 911 dispatcher he was in the middle of the road and hit something. He later said he thought he hit a deer or other animal and has insisted that neither he nor a sheriff who came to the scene could find what was hit in the dark. Investigators said they doubted some of Ravensburg's statements. I'm going to try and understand what really happened, Republican Senator Arthur Rush said in an email. How did he get on the shoulder? How did he not see Mr. Bover? How did he not see his face in the windshield? How did neither the AG nor the sheriff see the body when they walked right by it? During the House impeachment investigation, Ravensburg's defense centered on the constitutional grounds for impeachment and whether the two traffic misdemeanors, to which he pleaded no contest last year, were any reason to impeach him. He has also charged that Governor Kristi Noem politically weaponized the crash to drive him from office. Noem pressed the impeachment process along. After her administration argued for his removal, impeachment squeaked out of the House by a single vote. In the Senate, where it would require a two-thirds majority to convict Ravensburg, lawmakers have usually been on the same page with the governor. The political realities will certainly bear on senators' minds, said John Schaff, a political science professor at Northern State University. One would have to be naive to conclude that there's not at least some political element going on, he said. What do constituents think, and what does the governor think? Republican Senator V.J. Smith said he has been careful not to comment on the trial out of fairness, even as dozens of people in his community have asked him about it. But he said he's reminded of Bover's death every time he passes the spot where he died on U.S. Highway 14. It never really leaves you, he said. We're all looking for closure of a tragic situation. Judge, documents in Sanford investigation should be public. From Sioux Falls. A South Dakota judge ruled Thursday that there's no basis to keep sealed documents related to a child pornography investigation of billionaire banker and philanthropist T. Denny Sanford. Judge James Power wrote that affidavits supporting search warrants should be made public under South Dakota law, but he said they would remain sealed until Sanford and his attorneys decide whether to appeal the ruling to the state Supreme Court. Sanford attorney Stacy Heggie asked Power in an email last month to keep the affidavits sealed or at least be given additional time in order to seek relief from the Supreme Court. Heggie didn't immediately reply to an email Thursday. The South Dakota Attorney General's office declined to file charges against Sanford following the investigation, saying it found no prosecutable offenses within the state's jurisdiction, according to a court document filed last month. South Dakota investigators in 2019 began searching Sanford's email account, as well as his cellular and internet service providers, for possible possession of child pornography after his accounts were flagged by a technology firm. The investigation was first reported in 2020 by ProPublica and the Argus Leader. Both news outlets went to court for access to affidavits. The 86-year-old Sanford is the state's richest man, worth an estimated $3.4 billion. Sheldon woman acquitted in death of 5-month-old girl. Nick Hytrek reports from Primgar, Iowa. A Sheldon, Iowa woman has been acquitted of being an accessory after the death of a 5-month-old girl. Senior Judge David Larson on Wednesday ruled that the state had failed to prove Stacy Hurlburt gave help or advice to Lawrence Ruotolo Jr. and Brittany Baker in order to help them avoid arrest for the July 2020 death of their daughter. Hurlburt, 50, stood trial before Larson on 2 counts of accessory after the fact in April in O'Brien County District Court. She was accused of helping the parents concoct a story about how the child was injured so the Iowa Department of Human Services would not become involved. The state argued that her advice, by extension, was also an attempt to help them avoid arrest and prosecution. Hurlburt's lawyer argued that her advice was to help them avoid DHS involvement only. Larson sided with the defense, ruling Hurlburt's involvement was not intended to assist Ruotolo and Baker to avoid law enforcement. Ruotolo was caring for the child on July 26, 2020, at the Sheldon home he shared with Baker, when the child began crying and Ruotolo was unable to quiet her. He lost his temper and pushed the girl's face into the floor and committed other abusive actions, court documents said. Baker took the child to the emergency room, where she was treated for abrasions and bruising on her forehead, ears, and neck, and released. The following day, the child was again in Ruotolo's care when she was found with no pulse and was not breathing. She was taken to the emergency room and then airlifted to a Sioux Falls hospital where she died 4 days later. The death was caused by a suffocation event of an indeterminate nature, court documents said. Ruotolo, Baker, and Hurlburt were arrested in March 2021. Ruotolo, 21, was sentenced in September to 5 years in prison after pleading guilty to 1 count of child endangerment. Baker, 22, pleaded guilty in February to 1 count of child endangerment. Her 5-year prison sentence was suspended, and she was placed on 2 years probation. Residents in storm-ravaged South Dakota community still recovering. From Castlewood, South Dakota. Residents of a small community in northeastern South Dakota are still recovering from a wave of destructive storms a month ago. Piles of debris and broken tree limbs sit on the edge of town in Castlewood, a community of about 600 near Watertown. Some homes and buildings show fresh wood from repairs, while in other places a hole in the ground is the only sign of a former structure. Fallen trees with upturned roots are everywhere, and debris still litters some yards, South Dakota Public Broadcasting reported. According to the National Weather Service, 16 tornadoes hit eastern South Dakota and southwestern Minnesota on May 12. Castlewood was hit by an EF2 tornado that packed winds of 120 miles per hour and stayed on the ground for about 2 miles, or 3.2 kilometers. Mayor Brian Rees says that they are still assessing the extent of the damage in town. We've come a long ways, Rees said. We've got a lot of cleanup to do yet, a lot of rebuilding process to go through. I think most people's mentality right now is one day at a time type of thing. In total, around 20 structures in Castlewood are destroyed, while another 80 are damaged. No one died in Castlewood or suffered major injuries in the tornado. The school district's building, which houses preschool to senior high students, was one of the hardest hit locations in town. Superintendent Peter Brooks says almost half the school, specifically the elementary wing, is structurally unsound. Trading courtroom for the cattle yard. Retiring Judge Polson ready to return to agriculture. Nick Hytrek reports from Sioux City. Jeffrey Polson returned to Sioux City after law school as a self-described frustrated farmer, itching to get back into agriculture while beginning his legal career. A few decades later, he's not exactly heading out to pasture, but the retiring district court judge will have more time to work outside with his cattle instead of riding herd over lawyers and their clients in his courtroom. "It's time for me to start focusing on other things," Polson said, citing recent health issues that led friends and family to encourage him to retire after more than 11 years on the bench. "I like my job, and I have really drugged my feet on giving it up." Friday is his last day as a full-time judge. He plans to take senior status and a much lighter legal workload. In a roundabout way, agriculture led Polson into the legal profession. The Sioux City native raised hogs in high school and later worked on a farm owned by a lawyer. He said, "I think you'd make a good attorney. You have common sense," Polson said. Instead, he majored in animal science at the University of Wyoming. "After a year or two, I was fumbling around with that, and his words were still in my head," Polson said. He said he wasn't exactly sure what lawyers did, but he knew research and writing were involved, two things he enjoyed. "Any class that I could read books, write a couple term papers, and take essay exams, I did well in," he said. "It occurred to me maybe my skill set fit that pretty well." After receiving his law degree from Drake University in December 1976, Polson joined the Corbett Law Firm, where he worked until 2006, when he partnered with Bruce Thomas. After being a finalist for two previous judge openings, Polson was appointed to the bench in November 2010. During that whole time, he co-owned a cow-calf operation in rural Plymouth County, first partnering with his father, now with his son. His agricultural background came in handy as a lawyer, he said, sharing common experiences with many of his clients. "I always said I was bilingual. I could speak to farmers," he said. "A client hired me because I knew what a springing heifer was." As a lawyer during the farm crisis of the 1980s, Polson said he worked a couple years almost exclusively on ag-related cases, which covered a wide range of legal issues. That broad experience benefited him when he became a judge, but didn't fully prepare him. "As an attorney, you have an advanced degree in human nature," he said, "but as a judge, it's another rung up the ladder. Reality is stranger than fiction." When the stress of the job got to him, Polson said working outside with cattle always helped him recharge and refocus. "Half an hour later, you're a different person," he said. "Emotionally for me, it's a missing piece." Helping offenders who appeared before him become a different person has been one of the most gratifying aspects of being a judge, Polson said. He was instrumental in the formation and 2015 launch of the Woodbury County Veterans Treatment Court, a diversionary program that helps military veterans get their lives in order rather than go to prison. Polson has seen many veterans straighten out their lives through the specialty court. "That's probably one of my most rewarding parts of my career," he said. He's had his share of frustrating cases, too, the ones in which his decision can't solve the problems the case presents. He also doesn't like the recent trend toward politicization of the state's judiciary, from phasing district judges out of the judicial appointment process to political operatives interpreting rulings as a political statement. Polson said, "Politics plays no role in the decisions he and his fellow judges make. We're just trying to make the right decision every day we come into work," he said. Now, Polson will be making fewer of those decisions. He plans to take senior judge status, working 13 weeks a year and leaving more time to go fly fishing and travel out west with his wife, Jan, a Wyoming native. He'll be more available for farm chores, but said he won't be spending every day with the cows. He'll still be spending more time wearing a pair of dusty boots and a cowboy hat instead of a judge's robe, a prospect that leaves him anything but frustrated. Pathologist: child's fatal injuries may have been caused by CPR. 19-month-old suffered extensive internal injuries. Nick Hytrek reports from Sioux City. Doctors who examined Maylin Myers and the medical examiner who performed her autopsy were too quick to determine the toddler's injuries were the result of abusive events, an independent pathologist testified Thursday. Statements Tavon Davis made to investigators and doctors can explain the little girl's injuries were accidental, Dr. Thomas Young said. "You can't jump to conclusions that this is abusive trauma. What he, Davis, said is consistent with the outcome, said Young, a private forensic pathologist from Kansas City, Missouri, who testified in Davis's defense. Davis, 26, of Sioux City, is charged in Woodbury County District Court with first-degree murder, child endangerment resulting in the death of a child, and multiple acts of child endangerment. Prosecutors believe he injured Maylin numerous times in the days leading up to August 22, 2018, when Davis and Maylin's grandmother rushed the unresponsive toddler to a Sioux City emergency room. She was transferred to Children's Hospital in Omaha, where she never regained consciousness and died 3 days later. An Iowa State medical examiner testifying for the prosecution previously detailed the 19-month-old's injuries, which included bleeding throughout the brain, a left kidney dying because the blood vessel leading to it had been torn, hemorrhaging in both eyes, the girl's abdomen, and in the muscles of the back of her neck. X-rays showed healing fractures in the tibias of both legs and two vertebrae. All had fresh fractures in the healing bone material. At least three ribs were fractured. Maylin also had bruises on her forehead and the small of her back. Maylin's death was ruled a homicide caused by complications from blunt force injuries. Davis told investigators he dropped Maylin after giving her a bath on August 22nd, and she stopped breathing. His attempts at CPR were unsuccessful, but she was revived in the emergency room. The medical examiner and doctors testified the girl's injuries were too severe to be caused by being dropped, and CPR also was an unlikely cause. Young contradicted many of their findings, saying they failed to take into account Davis's explanations and other medical causes. If no one witnessed Maylin being intentionally hurt, Young said, her injuries can't be classified as abusive. Brain and eye hemorrhaging, such as Maylin exhibited, can occur after a person stops breathing, leading to blood vessels breaking and hemorrhaging as seen in Maylin's organs. The breathing stoppage also can slow blood clotting, leading to bruises caused by medical staff handling a patient. Young said evidence of pneumonia in Maylin could explain why she stopped breathing, or there could be no explanation. This was a very sick child, Young said in reference to her many trips to the doctor in the weeks before her death and her recent bouts with infections and hand, foot, and mouth disease. Davis's CPR attempts, which Young told jurors could have been hundreds of fast, hard compressions, could have caused the broken ribs, internal bruising, and kidney damage. The arm, leg, and back fractures, possibly the result of frantic handling of the girl once she was unresponsive. Healing material on bones can result from an infection or other causes. During her cross-examination of Young, who said he was being paid $450 an hour by the defense, Assistant Woodbury County Attorney Christine Timmons challenged his assertion that all of Maylin's injuries could be explained by Davis's CPR attempts. She read from a transcript of Davis's police interview in which he told them he did a couple chest compressions. Would a couple CPR compressions in the car on Maylin Myers have caused her injuries? Timmons asked. Young said he didn't know the context of Davis's statements to police, so he couldn't say. But it didn't make sense to him that Davis would only have done two compressions when Maylin was facing death. Earlier Thursday, Maylin's mother, Shannon Myers, testified that Davis spent increasing amounts of time alone watching Maylin in August when she became concerned about her daughter's frequent vomiting, lack of energy, inability to gain weight, and loss of appetite. The girl was diagnosed with hand, foot, and mouth disease earlier in the month, but doctors gave Myers a few other answers for her symptoms. An August 20th skull X-ray showed no head injuries. Myers said under cross-examination that she also would have been alone with Maylin for several hours each night while Davis was at work. While you were dating Tavon, Maylin never seemed afraid of Tavon, is that correct? Public defender Jennifer Solberg asked Myers. That's correct, Myers said. Both the state and defense rested their cases Thursday, and Davis did not testify. The trial will resume Monday when the case may be submitted to the jury. If found guilty of first-degree murder, Davis would face a mandatory sentence of life in prison without parole. South Sioux City announces economic development project. The city of South Sioux City has announced a new economic development project to spur growth and job creation for small businesses. With grant funding from the U.S. Department of Commerce Economic Development Administration, the city will soon begin construction of Commerce Way, a critical infrastructure project serving the All-American subdivision. The proposed project constructs approximately 1,550 linear feet of paved street to complete a commercial subdivision, which will provide for light industry, warehouse, distribution centers, and service areas, according to a statement from the city. The project will subdivide 24 acres into 12 lots and install the necessary infrastructure for business development, such as road paving, sewer and water, storm sewer, electrical, and communications. The statement said the opening of Commerce Way will increase the number of shovel-ready sites in South Sioux City and is projected to create 56 high-quality jobs in transportation and other crucial industries. Several firms are already planning to purchase this land for their expansion. Having quality land complete with paving, water, sewer, and fiber optics is ideal for attracting new and expanding businesses, South Sioux City Mayor Rod Koch said in the statement. The U.S. Department of Commerce Economic Development Administration's investment is designed to establish a foundation for sustainable job growth and the building of durable regional economies throughout the United States. This foundation builds upon two key economic drivers, innovation and regional collaboration. And now a couple of local news briefs. South Sioux Senior Center needs volunteers to reopen. The South Sioux City Senior Center has closed its doors but is working on a plan to reopen, according to a statement from the city. Approximately 90 seniors, homebound individuals, are served at the center at 1501 West 29th Street and with home-delivered meals. The city has agreed to assist the center with reopening efforts. The statement said the center needs to recruit volunteers to help deliver meals, replace its delivery van, and fill the following part-time paid positions: director, cook, and office manager. Monetary donations will also be needed to assist in the startup of the center. Those interested in helping with the center's reopening can contact the city administrator's office at 402-494-7517. And finally, municipal band salutes fathers from Sioux City. The Sioux City Municipal Band will salute dads during a special Father's Day concert at 7:30 p.m. Sunday at the Grandview Park Bandshell. Led by conductor Michael Pritchard, the concert will include Carl King's The Melody Shop March, John Philip Sousa's The Gladiator March, Jay Chataway's Parade of the Tall Ships, as well as music from the Broadway show Les Miserables. Ben Bruflat, an assistant professor of music at Lincoln Memorial University of Harrogate, Tennessee, will perform a trumpet solo in Alexander Arutunian's trumpet concerto. KCAU-TV news anchor Tim Seaman, the substitute host, will lead the traditional sing-along with For He's a Jolly Good Fellow and Lift Every Voice and Sing. Presented by the Sioux City Parks and Recreation Department, the Municipal Band's summer concert series will continue through July 24th. Once again, you are listening to this reading of the Sioux City Journal for today, Friday, June 17th, on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. And now we turn to today's obituaries. Elizabeth Rose Mary Betty Freaking, 86, of Lamars, entered into eternal life on Wednesday, June 15th, 2022, at Good Samaritan Society in Lamars. Mass of Christian burial will be held at 1 p.m. on Saturday at All Saints Catholic Parish, St. Joseph Church in Lamars, with the Reverend Bruce Lawler as celebrant. Burial will follow in Calvary Cemetery in Lamars, with her seven surviving sons as pallbearers. Visitation with the family present will begin at 4 p.m. today, with a Catholic Daughter's Rosary at 5 p.m. and a scriptural prayer service at 7 p.m., all at the church. There will also be 1 hour of visitation at the church before the funeral on Saturday. Arrangements are with Maurer Johnson Funeral Home in Lamars. Expressions of sympathy may be directed to the family at maurerjohnsonfh.com. Pardon me, that's maurer-johnsonfh.com. Betty was born July 14, 1935, in Lamars, the daughter of Henry and Gertrude Wersinger Bush. She was baptized at St. Mary's Catholic Church in Remsen, Iowa, and confirmed at Holy Name Catholic Church. She attended Holy Name High School in Marcus, Iowa. Betty worked as a telephone operator and seamstress before marrying Herman Jr. Clem Freaking Jr. on May 3, 1956, at Holy Name Catholic Church in Marcus. Betty and Jr. farmed east of Lamars, while she also took on a position at Alf's in Lamars after her 13 children had all reached school age. Betty later worked as a caregiver at the Abbey for nearly 20 years, working there to stay close to her loving husband, Jr., as he resided there for 12 years after suffering from a debilitating stroke. Betty will be lovingly remembered for her devotion to her family and faith. She attended and supported All Saints Catholic Church and the Galen Catholic Schools. She was a member of the Catholic Daughters. She was known for her modesty, generosity, gentleness, respect for others, and quiet strength. As she was easily embarrassed, this became a constant connection between her and her children, as they loved to tease her. Memorials in Betty's name may be made to Galen Catholic Schools for future scholarships. Linda K. Wright, 72, of Correctionville, passed away Tuesday, June 14th, at her son's home, surrounded by family. A private family burial will be held at the Correctionville Cemetery. Arrangements are with Nicholas D. Jensen Funeral Home of Correctionville. Online condolences can be made at nicholasdjensenfh.com. Linda was born on April 29, 1950, to Lowell and Winifred Kuschel. She grew up on a farm outside of Holstein. She attended USD in Vermilion before going to work at Blue Cross Blue Shield, where she worked in the Medicare department for more than 30 years. Linda was united in marriage to Barry Fred Wright on July 30, 1972. To this union, two children were born, Jen and Josh. She enjoyed going to her lake home in Okoboji and traveling to Las Vegas to the casinos. She also enjoyed reading, quilting, shopping on QVC, but most of all spending time with her family. Josina Josie Eggdorf, 92, of Ankeny, died Tuesday, June 14th. Services will be June 18th at 2 p.m. at St. Andrew's United Methodist Church in Sanborn. Burial will be at Pleasant Hill Cemetery in Primgar, Iowa. Visitation will be June 17th from 5 to 7 p.m. at Sanborn Funeral Home in Sanborn. Lester Grass, that's G-R-A-S-Z, 97, of Lamars, died Wednesday, June 15th. Services will be June 21st at 10:30 a.m. at Grace Lutheran Church in Lamars. Burial will take place following the services at Rest Haven Memory Gardens in Lamars. Visitation will be June 20th from 5 to 7 p.m. at Rex Winkle Funeral Home in Lamars, and resumes June 21st from 9:30 a.m. until service time at the church. And finally, Shirley Jelkin, 96, of Lamars, died Thursday, June 16th. Services will be June 22nd at 10:30 a.m. at St. John's Lutheran Church in Lamars. Burial will follow the services at Memorial Cemetery in Lamars. Visitation will be June 21st from 4 to 7 p.m. at Rex Winkle Funeral Home in Lamars, and resumes June 22nd from 9:30 a.m. until service time at the church. And now these stories in national and world news. Biden, recession is not inevitable. Josh Boak reports from Washington. President Joe Biden said Thursday the American people are really, really down after a tumultuous 2 years with the coronavirus pandemic, volatility in the economy, and now surging gasoline prices that are slamming family budgets. But he stressed that a recession was not inevitable and held out hope of giving the country a greater sense of confidence. Speaking to the Associated Press in a 30-minute Oval Office interview, the president emphasized the battered economy that he inherited and the lingering psychological scars caused by a pandemic that disrupted people's sense of identity. He bristled at claims by Republican lawmakers that last year's COVID-19 aid plan was fully to blame for inflation reaching a 40-year high, calling that argument bizarre. As for the overall American mindset, Biden said people are really, really down. The need for mental health in America, it has skyrocketed because people have seen everything upset, Biden said. Everything they've counted on upset. but most of it's the consequence of what happened as a consequence of the COVID crisis. That pessimism has carried over into the economy, as record prices at the pump and persistent inflation have jeopardized Democrats' ability to hold on to the House and Senate in the midterm elections. Biden addressed the warnings by economists that fighting inflation could tip the United States into recession. First of all, it's not inevitable, he said. Secondly, we're in a stronger position than any nation in the world to overcome this inflation. Wall Street wasn't as optimistic Thursday as stocks tumbled on worries that the world's fragile economy may buckle under higher interest rates. The S&P 500 fell 3.3% in a widespread rout to more than reverse its blip of a 1.5% rally from a day before. Analysts had warned of more big swings given deep uncertainties about whether the Federal Reserve and other central banks can hike interest rates enough to get inflation under control, but not so much as to cause a recession. As for the causes of inflation, Biden flashed some defensiveness on that count. If it's my fault, why is it the case in every other major industrial country in the world that inflation is higher? You ask yourself that? I'm not being a wise guy, he said. The president said he saw reason for optimism with the 3.6% unemployment rate and America's relative strength in the world. Be confident, because I am confident we're better positioned than any country in the world to own the second quarter of the 21st century, Biden said. That's not hyperbole, that's a fact. Biden's bleak assessment of the national psyche comes as voters have soured on his job performance and the direction of the country. Only 39% of U.S. adults approve of Biden's performance as president, according to a May poll from the Associated Press NORC Center for Public Research, dipping from already negative ratings a month earlier. Overall, only about 2 in 10 adults said the U.S. is heading in the right direction or that the economy is good, both down from about 3 in 10 in April. Those drops were concentrated among Democrats, with just 33% within the president's party saying the country is headed in the right direction, down from 49% in April. Biden said Republican social policies were contributing to public anxieties. He suggested GOP lawmakers could face consequences in the midterms if the Supreme Court overturns Roe v. Wade, possibly removing national protections for abortion access. Voters will consider the failure of this Republican Party to be willing to respond to the basic social concerns of the country, the president said. The president outlined some of the hard choices he has faced, saying the U.S. needed to stand up to Russian President Vladimir Putin for invading Ukraine in February, even though tough sanctions imposed as a result of that war have caused gas prices to surge, creating a political risk for Biden in an election year. He called on oil companies to think of the world's short-term needs and increase production. Asked why he ordered the financial penalties against Moscow that have disrupted food and energy markets globally, Biden said he made his calculation as commander-in-chief rather than as a politician thinking about the election. "I'm the president of the United States," he said. "It's what's best in the country. No kidding. No kidding." So what happens? What happens if the strongest power in NATO, the organizational structure we put together, walked away from Russian aggression? In news about the Capitol riot investigation, panel. Plot for Pence to reject electors, nuts. From Washington. Donald Trump's extraordinary effort to overturn his 2020 election defeat came into ever clearer focus Thursday, with testimony describing his pressuring Vice President Mike Pence in vulgar private taunts and public entreaties to stop the certification of Joe Biden's victory in the run-up to the January 6th Capitol insurrection. Trump's closest advisors viewed his last-ditch efforts to halt congressional certification of his loss as, quote, nuts, quote, crazy, and even likely to incite riots if Pence followed through, witnesses revealed in stark testimony Thursday. The panel revealed how Trump put his vice president in danger as Pence was presiding over a joint session of Congress on January 6, 2021, when the defeated president sent his supporters to the Capitol to fight like hell over his false claims of a fraudulent election. Rioters came within 40 feet of the place at the Capitol where Pence and others had been evacuated. Never before shown photos showed Pence and his team sheltering. He deserves to be burned with the rest of them, one rioter is heard saying on video as the mob prepares to storm the iconic building. Pence betrayed us, says another rioter, wearing a Make America Great Again hat in a selfie video inside the Capitol. Pence's counsel, Greg Jacob, testified that he could hear the din of the rioters nearby. Asked if Trump ever checked on Pence during the siege, Jacob said he did not. With live testimony and other evidence from its year-long investigation, the panel held its third hearing this month, aiming to demonstrate that Trump's repeated false claims and desperate attempt to stay in power led directly to the Capitol insurrection. All told, the committee is pulling together a dark portrait of the end of Trump's presidency as the defeated Republican was left grasping for alternatives as courts turned back dozens of lawsuits challenging the vote. Trump latched onto conservative law professor John Eastman's obscure plan to defy historical precedent of the Electoral Count Act and reverse Joe Biden's victory. Trump aides and allies warned bluntly in private about his efforts, even as some publicly continued to stand by the president's false election claims. 9 people died in the insurrection and its aftermath. "Are you out of your effing mind?" Eric Hirschman, a lawyer advising Trump, told Eastman in recorded testimony shown at the hearing. "You're going to turn around and tell 78-plus million people in this country that your theory is how you're going to invalidate their votes," Hirschman said. He warned, "You're going to cause riots in the streets." A text message from Fox News' Sean Hannity to Trump's chief of staff, Mark Meadows, about the plan in the run-up to January 6th read, "I'm very worried about the next 48 hours. Leaders pledge arms for Ukraine. Countries also signal path for membership into European Union. From Kyiv, Ukraine. 4 European leaders expressed their support for Ukraine on Thursday while meeting with President Volodymyr Zelensky, vowing to back Kyiv's candidacy to eventually join the European Union and offering more weapons to fend off Russia's invasion. French President Emmanuel Macron promised Ukraine 6 more truck-mounted artillery guns, the latest in a new round of Western arms pledges, as the war grinds on in the Donbas region in the east. France, Germany, Italy, and Romania are doing everything so that Ukraine alone can decide its fate," Macron said at a news conference with Zelensky and the others. "My colleagues and I have come here to Kyiv today with a clear message. Ukraine belongs to the European family," said German Chancellor Olaf Scholz. Amid Ukrainian fears that Western resolve could wane, the visit carried heavy symbolism. France, Germany, and Italy have all faced criticism for continuing to engage with Russian President Vladimir Putin and failing to give Kyiv the weaponry it says it needs. With Scholz beside him, Macron defended earlier comments that riled Ukrainians about not humiliating Russia, solemnly noting how the end of World War I had sown the seeds of World War II. "We are side by side today with Chancellor Scholz. 100 years ago, we were at war and allies helped France win. France committed a historic mistake. It lost the peace because it wanted to humiliate Germany. The question of humiliation I always placed in a context to come, not the current context," he said. In his nightly video address, Zelensky said it was important for him to hear that European leaders agree the end of the war and peace for Ukraine should be as Ukraine sees them. He said Ukrainians will continue to fight for all of their land. Many in Ukraine hope the visit could mark a turning point by opening the way to significant new arms supplies. It also comes as EU leaders prepare to decide next week on Ukraine's request to become a candidate for membership. The war has increased pressure on EU governments to fast-track Ukraine's candidate status, and Thursday's pledge to support candidacy status for Ukraine and Moldova pushes the whole 27-nation union closer to doing so. But the process still is expected to take years, and EU members remain divided over how quickly and fully to open their arms to new members. And now these stories in local sports. Warriors stretch out their lead. SBL earns 10th consecutive win. Bailey Zubke reports from Sergeant Bluff. When catcher Bryce Click stepped up to the plate to lead things off Thursday afternoon, his team already had a 2-run advantage. Sergeant Bluff Luton and Sioux City East were in a 5-3 battle earlier this season when the game had to be stopped due to the weather. That game resumed in the top of the fourth inning Thursday at Sergeant Bluff Luton Elementary, and the Warriors stretched a 2-run lead to 11 by the end of it, defeating East 19-8. It's a weird situation when you have to make up a game and you still have your doubleheader, so there's a lot of thought into a lot of different parts of it, Warriors coach Matt Nelson said. How we're going to pitch it, how you're going to work your pitching around it, and we had a really good batting practice today. The four innings of action preceded a doubleheader scheduled for the evening, so the two schools had to be creative about how they were going to approach the first game of the day. It worked out for the Warriors as they scored 5 runs in the fourth and 3 in the fifth to build a 10-run lead. A 3-run home run by Carter Brown highlighted the fourth inning scoring for the Warriors. A 3-run homer by Drake Van Meter to almost the exact same spot as Brown's homer made it a 13-3 game. East broke through the bottom of the fifth to keep the game alive. Andrew Brown hit a 2-run double to cap off the inning, cutting the Warrior lead in half. Click scored on a wild pitch turned into a throwing error in the top of the sixth. Easton Wheeler scored on a walk by Van Meter and Brown drive one in on a single. Tyler Lutkin scored on a wild pitch and the lead was back to 9 for Sergeant Bluff Luton. A 2-run home run in the top of the ninth by Aiden Ciaperda stretched the lead back out to 11 for the Warriors, and Cole Conlon finished things off on the mound in the bottom of the seventh. One thing about our field that almost everyone knows is we have kind of a small field, but we don't see home runs all the time, Nelson said. When guys get it up in the lit stream a little bit and hit it, we always have two goals. Our righties, we want to hit the school beyond left field, and our lefties, we want to hit somebody on the softball field beyond right field. We had a couple of pretty good shots today. Including the results of the first 3 innings back in May, Brown finished the game with 5 hits and 6 RBIs. Van Meter drove in 5 RBIs. Wheeler had 3 hits. Andrew Brown led East with 3 hits and 2 RBIs. Aiden Halkup took the loss on the mound, although he didn't pitch in Thursday's portion of the game. The win marks Sergeant Bluff Luton's 10th consecutive win on the season, with their last loss coming June 2nd against Council Bluffs Lincoln. The Warriors also hold first place in the Missouri River Conference, creating separation on second place East with the win. The doubleheader originally scheduled for Thursday night was not completed in time for print. The lineup is pretty solid. Zach James reports from Mobile, Iowa. The Kingsley Pearson High School baseball team had a 12-run fourth inning that helped the Panthers beat Woodbury Central 16-6 in 5 innings on Wednesday night. After the game, Panthers senior Evan Newman said it was the Panthers' best offensive inning of the season among their 13-3 season. There's been a few offensive outbursts for the Panthers so far this season, but not against a quality team like the Wildcats. Newman was the second hitter up to the plate during that fourth inning and doubled home Connor Bielner, who led off the inning with a walk. Malachi Christofferson then doubled home Newman, and that's where the rally exploded. The Panthers had 7 hits in the game. 3 hitters were also hit by Wildcats pitchers, and that also impacted a 12-run, 17-hitter inning. This offense is about as potent of an offense as I've had in my 6-year career, said Panthers coach Taylor Deschott, D-O-E-S-C-H-O-T. Like I told the guys, anybody 1-9, they're capable of getting the job done. Whether it's small ball or barreling up for a single or double, the lineup is pretty solid. The start of that big inning, we bunted a run home, and we built it up and barreled some runs up. The Panthers collected 13 hits of the night, including 3 from Newman, Bielner, and Bo Bubke each had 2. We had a talk in the dugout before that inning that we needed to put them away, Newman said. We needed to jump ahead, and we did. We like to be aggressive with bunting and stealing bases. We love to do that. Boston Deschott took the win in relief. He threw 2 2/3 innings and struck out 5. He allowed 3 earned runs on 1 hit. Newman also took the mound for the first time in 2 weeks. Because of how the Panthers' schedule worked, Newman and Boston DeShott didn't get a chance to pitch. Newman got 25 pitches under his belt and recorded the final 4 outs with those quarter-century pitches. He allowed a hit and a walk and also struck out a batter. "It felt good, and sometimes it's good to take a break," Newman said. "I was ready to go in and do my job. There's definitely a lot more I can do. I have a lot of room between now and postseason to get stronger." Newman said he needs to hunker down on his off-speed pitches. He said that he needs to slow down a little bit and tighten his grip. He was going to go in whether it was a tight ball game or it wasn't a tight ball game, Taylor DeShott said. "We need him to get some innings in. We have a game Friday and possibly 2 Saturday. We're going to need him this weekend." McIlwraith bears down as Explorers closer. Zach James reports from Sioux City. Thomas McIlwraith isn't afraid to serve as the Sioux City Explorers closer. He comes to the mound late in games, hoping to seal the deal on a potential win, which the X's have done a lot of lately since starting off the season at 3-12. On Wednesday night against Kansas City in a 7-6 win, McIlwraith earned the win on the mound, which was his second of the season. He's 2-1 on the season with a .54 earned run average in 16 2/3 innings. He's got 8 saves. McIlwraith hasn't allowed an earned run since June 1st. "It's the first time in my career where I've had a role," McIlwraith said. "I know when I'm going and I know when I need to get ready. I can get a routine with it, so it's nice. Early on, I had to get my feet wet. I had to bear down with my mindset." Wednesday's win was his first since June 4th. McIlwraith, who attended the University of Oklahoma, has gone 8 2/3 innings where he hasn't allowed an earned run. During that span, too, he struck out 10 batters. "It's all hands on deck every single night, and if it's me having to close out ball games, then I'm more than happy to do so," McIlwraith said. "I'm happy to have that role solidified." After he completed his time with the Sooners, McIlwraith was taken by the New York Mets in the 20th round of the 2015 Major League Baseball June Amateur Draft. He had only recorded 1 save with the Mets farm system, and that came in 2019 with High A St. Lucie. McIlwraith pitched in 93 games inside the Mets farm system, and he had a 3.73 ERA. 14 of those games came at AA Binghamton last year, where he went 1-2 with a 6.23 ERA. Now that he's in Sioux City, manager Steve Montgomery will hand McIlwraith the ball anytime there's a save situation. "He's gotten the job done," Montgomery said. "He's been consistent. He's not a guy who is going to walk you. He's going to challenge you. Thomas can throw 3 pitches for strikes, and you don't know what's coming. He's able to throw off speed early in the count." As for the game itself, Sioux City needed to score late even to give McIlwraith a chance to pitch on Wednesday night. The X's trailed 6-3, heading into that frame. Nate Sampson and Gabe Snyder earned 1-out walks, and Blake Tiberi had a RBI single that scored Sampson. With 2 outs, Chase Harris had a 2-run single to center field, and that scored Tiberi and Snyder. Harris earned his 10th and 11th RBIs with that hit. After McIlwraith pitched a scoreless 9th and 10th innings, Tiberi had a game-winning RBI double that scored Trey Martin. Sioux City tried to force a sweep over at Kansas City on Thursday, and then Cleburne comes to town for the weekend 3-game series. And finally, a couple of briefs, one from Prep Softball. Jones highlights East's comeback. From Sergeant Bluff, the East High School softball team scored 2 runs in the 6th and 7th innings to win 5-4 in Game 1 of a tripleheader on Thursday over Sergeant Bluff Luton. The Warriors scored 4 runs right away in the game, as they were the road team. This was supposed to be the second game of a doubleheader held at East Stadium earlier this season, but that game got rained out. Olivia Mintzer led off the 7th inning by reaching base on an error. Then Raylan Angerman hit a single to put 2 on. Kennedy Wineland forced a walk to load the bases. Alexi Jones singles on a ground ball to right field, and that allowed Mincer and Angerman to score to clinch the win. The Warriors had 7 hits, and Chloe Buss had 2 of those hits. Jones also had 2 hits for the Black Raiders, as her other hit was a double. The other two games finished after journal deadline. And finally, in prep baseball, Rebels rally late for road win. Bunkers throws four-inning perfect game from Mapleton, Iowa. The Westwood High School baseball team broke a three-game losing streak to MVAOCOU on Wednesday night with an 8-7 road win over the Rams. The Rams led 4-2 after the first inning, but the Rebels scored five unanswered runs in the third and fourth innings. Both teams had four hits, and neither team had a multi-hit batter. Westwood sophomore Mickey Hansen had two RBIs. Rams junior TJ Nutt had two RBIs and a double. And that does it for today's reading of the Sioux City Journal for today, Friday, June 17th. I'm your reader, Mark Bedford. You can access a recording of today's reading in our website, iowaradioreading.org, at any time. And thanks for listening.